Got about left. So I really have so much appreciation for the YU Kollel, Torah Mitzion Kollel. First, they brought me back to Ida Crown. I wasn't sure if I was allowed back in. But they took care of it, and I was able to speak there about 2 months ago, and then to return here. I was just thinking, I probably spoke here last Shavuos 2005 on the Hakdama of Mishneh Torah. I remember exactly where I was. I remember Rabbi Weil telling me where I made a mistake in translation, and it really is a real thrill to be back. Because Chicago, for many respects, was the most formative experience in my life. That being said, not only do I express my appreciation, but whether you like or whether you disagree with the next hour, in some respects, it's your all fault. Every field has philosophical differences. Every profession, when one enters it, he or she needs to make particular decisions. You have to come out on one side or the other. So for the rabbinate, it might be whether or not to hold by the Eruv. For a Chicagoan, it's the 1985 Bears or the 1996 Chicago Bulls. And for American Jewish historians, it is whether or not, in fact, America was exceptional. Does one read and write the history of Jews in the United States as something different than the experience of Jews in Europe or in other locales? Is it different or is it the same? And that is something that the historian negotiates throughout her or his career. I want to take, though, a step further than American exceptionalism, whether or Jews, in fact, deserve this level of triumphalism, that America is underish, that it is somewhat different. Is it the golden of Medina, or is it the trafen of Medina? It works both ways. I want to take it to another level, and I want to understand if the historical actors themselves, how they understood whether or not the Jewish experience in the United States could indeed be refracted in such a way, interpreted as exceptional. See what I mean by that. I want to look at it from the lens of Chabad, one of the most dynamic, one of the most interesting Jewish communities in the United States, no doubt. I think everybody would agree with that. And I also want to look at the view of Chabad by other Jews in the United States. I'd like to postulate three dates which are perhaps three of the most pivotal for the history of Lubavitch in the United States. First is March 19th, 1940. Anybody know what happened on that date? The sixth Lubavitch Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, arrived on Ellis Island. In fact, one of the first statements in the mythology of Chabad that he stated upon disembarking from the boat was, like I said, America nicht anders, that America is no different. The court that I established in Riga will be transplanted to the United States. And that's what he offered to his court at that time. The next date, June 23rd, 1941, over a little bit more than a year later. How about this one? Anybody know what this date was?
Is that when the last Lubavitch Rebbe came over from France?
Exactly right. The son-in-law of the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, he too migrated to the United States, and it was a formative point in the history of Chabad. It was not at all clear that he would become the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe. A few biographies have come out in the last 5 years which make it quite clear about that. But he arrives, and that is the beginning of the transition. The sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe would live for about another 9 years, and the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, would emerge as the undisputed leader of the Hasidic dynasty of Chabad. Now you might argue the third date I would suggest will be 1950, when the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe assumes the mantle of leadership of Chabad. But I'm going to suggest a different date, about 30 years later, November 4th, 1980. Anybody know? You all know this date. Many of you, I know exactly where you were on November 4th, 1980. Anybody know?
Election Day.
What happened on that day? It was a landslide. The incumbent Jimmy Carter. What happened? He lost. I report the news. I don't editorialize, although I've been accused of such. He lost to the former governor of California, Ronald Reagan. And President Reagan's administration, he's a two-term president. People thought he wiped the floor with Carter. Well, they'll wait 4 years with Mondale. It was an even greater landslide. The administration, the presidency, the 1980s in the Reagan era was a tremendous decade for Chabad. Why do I suggest that? First of all, Ronald Reagan supports school-sponsored prayer in the public school. The Lubavitcher Rebbe was a great advocate of that, that there should be some time set aside for a religious activity in the public school. 1984, Ronald Reagan offers the Equal Access Act, which compelled federally funded schools to provide equal access to all extracurricular activities, not just prayer, but there could be religious space inside what you might think is a secular space of the public school. And number three, I'll give you an example that Ronald Reagan was very, very public with his relationships with the Moral Majority, Jerry Falwell, and other members of the Christian right, and so too of the Orthodox right, I think, somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's in 1988, where Ronald Reagan signs off on Lubavitcher Rebbe Day, or something like that. And so Ronald Reagan challenges both not just the infiltration, that's not exactly the word I'm looking for, but I would say the negotiation and the balance of the separation of church and state. Where does the separation of church and state come from? Anybody know?
Constitution.
In the Constitution, but to be clearer,
the First Amendment.
More specifically, it's called the Establishment Clause. For my PhD, Jonathan Sarna had me memorize much of the Constitution. Wonderful, benevolent despot who I love dearly. Now I can say it in a recorded fashion. Where the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That is a quote from the First Amendment called the Establishment Clause. And in many respects, this was the bedrock of American Jewish exceptionalism. For at least three centuries, since 1654, because this was much in the air, although the Establishment Clause wasn't established until the final decades of the 18th century, nevertheless, didn't come out of nowhere. Certainly already in New Amsterdam, there was a culture of a barrier between church and state, and in British America as well. Americans thought that they had gained a foothold in the United States, particularly because, in contradistinction, I should say, to Europe, because there was such a separation. There was such a distinction that why can the Jew make it? Because you need not be a Christian. You need not be, or more particularly, a Protestant in this country to make it in America. Sound agreeable so far? Nobody's armed with tomatoes yet. Okay. Well, Ronald Reagan changes much of that. Some of the examples I provided. And what it does is enables an interpretation in several facets of Chabad to challenge the separation of church and state. And for my topic, I've selected Chabad menorahs. So this is a pamphlet that I bought on Amazon for 99 cents. Arrived just in time. In 1985, Hanukkah, a lesson in religious freedom. And here, not much text. Rather, just pictures. Chabad really... The genius of many geniuses of Chabad, one is just PR. Images. What are these images of? Can anybody see? Menorahs. Not just menorahs.
Public.
Excuse me?
Public.
Public display of menorahs. And why might that challenge the separation of church and state? In 1979.
It was done on public property.
Done on public property in parks. On the steps of city halls. Anybody know the first time a Chabad menorah was publicly displayed? People claim it's 1976. Some Chabad historians claim it's 1976 in Philadelphia, Rabbi Shem Tov. There is what to suggest that, that was the case. I've seen once that it was, somebody claims in 1979 in Washington, D.C. with Jimmy Carter. That's absolutely not correct, although that was the first time that a president, he actually had quarantined himself in unity quarantine with the situation in Iran, and his first public appearance, President Carter lit the menorah again, not editorializing, Tzvi Dinim and Jimmy Carter perhaps, but actually, the very first time that a Chabad menorah was lit, a large public menorah was lit, and I use lit, maybe that's not the most precise word, screwed on, is correct, right? They generally, it's not the practice of Chabad to formally light with a bracha, an important point that we'll get to in a moment. But if you turn to the packet, it's a bulky packet, I apologize. But first, to page 4. They do light with a bracha. And I know there are some exceptional cases. But the lion's share of instances is not to light with a bracha. That'll come up very important in Pittsburgh in 1987-1988. This is, and I have to thank the fine archivist at Congregation Emmanuel in San Francisco for this, was a bulletin, in a synagogue bulletin in the Reform Congregation Emmanuel, by this Rabbi Asher, who was a longtime rabbi, a very important Reform leader in the Bay Area, and he writes the following. Everybody have page 4. The First Amendment, assault from an unexpected source. It never fails, I'm starting from the beginning, but each year at this time, the fundamental principle of the separation of church and state is challenged by way of the all-pervasive preoccupation with Christmas celebrations. Jews very much felt under siege come December time with all of the public displays, not of menorahs, but of Christmas trees. Felt very much on guard in November, December time because America is the place for religious freedom. We don't put up our Shabbos candles. We don't bake our challahs in public spaces. So you, fine Protestant neighbors, don't display your Christmas trees in the malls, in the public spaces. And many Jewish organizations, Reform was at the forefront, but Orthodox and conservative and secular organizations, the American Jewish Congress, first and foremost, really went to bat on the state level, state Supreme Courts, and even in the federals, in the United States Supreme Court, to combat the positioning of Christian objects in the public sphere. So, it was nothing new, according to Rabbi Asher. However, what happened? This year, in 1975, our own Jewish commitment to the... Remember, he's calling it the Jewish, doesn't say reform, and he's right. The strictest interpretation of the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, he too studied with Professor Sarna, has been less than effective on that score. Yet we managed to uphold our purity of purpose in that we avoided compromising it by gaining equal time for Hanukkah toward the whittling away of the wall of separation. So Hanukkah emerged as an important holiday, but never could Rabbi Asher or many Jews imagine that we would use the same tactic, perhaps, as their Protestant neighbors. So what does he say? Skipping down to the next paragraph, who would have thought Jews would now offer the newest challenge to the guarantees of the Bill of Rights, that we would be challenging American church and state division, and indeed exceptionalism. A giant menorah, not a little one like the one in Philadelphia a year later, a giant menorah is now on display in Union Square. Everybody been to Union Square? I would have to save every nickel for about a decade to afford to purchase space in Union Square. Very, very expensive area. Twitter basically owns it at this point. Or at least to equal the Christmas tree. Interesting, the Christmas, we'll talk about that, the Christmas tree as a religious object. And each day, at the appropriate time, for 8 days, it will be lit with the traditional blessings, he wasn't correct about this, and the singing and dancing of Hanukkah carols. A very, one thing you might learn from history is the use of polemical language. Some people are klutzes about it. Some people are very, very clever with the positioning of language. This exercise is touted as a breakthrough by the Chabad House of Berkeley. I think Rabbi Kunin was the rabbi at that time. A neo-Hasidic sect. I don't think at this point Rabbi Shlomo Carbach was involved with this. I don't understand neo-Hasidic exactly. The sponsors and promoters of it. It is a symbol. Their announcement reads to reflect the resurgence of pride in our cultural heritage that has made such an event possible. So what's happening in this text? What's happening here? Hanukkah carols. What is Rabbi Asher protecting against? Any ideas?
His definition of freedom of religion is separated.
His definition of freedom of religion. Correct. Now, is it just the menorahs? Is the, we'll call it the non-Orthodox for a moment. Funny word, non-Orthodox. That's basically 90% of religious Jews in America are non-Orthodox, but yeah, we'll refer to it as that. The non-Orthodox position on Chabad, is it just informed about separation of church and state? Is it just this this flirtation with Christmas trees and giant menorahs? I saw a nod. What else is...
The idea of the Chabad, what they would call Kiruv proselytizing.
Okay.
They don't like the idea that possibly they feel disrespected. We have a legitimate a view of Judaism, and they're trying to shove what they say is authentic Judaism down our throats, and we don't like the idea that we aren't an equal of theirs. We have more. We have more numbers. Why aren't we getting respect?
Okay, and I would say that you are being a little bit fierce with your language, if not for Source 1, which echoes much of what you were suggesting. A rabbi of a Reformed temple, the Jewish World, a very important Long Island Jewish newspaper at the time, Mayakar Natov to the Widener Library at Harvard for letting me sit down for about 3 months and just scrolling through the microfilm to grab every interesting article I could find. Dear editor, I have read, remember, 1981, so we're skipping a little bit, but it reflects a certain attitude, a culture that has really seized the non-Orthodox in particular for some time. I have read Stuart Ain's recent article. Stuart Ain still writes for the Jewish Week, a very fine reporter. Lubavitch sponsors study groups in Nassau pertaining to adult education on Long Island being sponsored by the Lubavitch Movement. Interesting, movement. Lubavitch separate from Orthodox, which is a very interesting point. What disturbs me is, again, the intrusion of the Lubavitch movement. I just report the news, remember. Into the lives of the Reform and Conservative communities and other Orthodox communities of Long Island. There is an assumption implicit in their offerings. Number one, that they alone offer the possibility for satisfying adult Jewish education. Number two, that they alone have the authentic insight, almost verbatim, you anticipated this, into Jewish tradition, and they best can teach it. And there are other quotes, a conservative rabbi, I don't think I have it on this source sheet, but there's another wonderful quote about a conservative rabbi saying he sent his daughter to a college, to an Ivy League college campus, and she came home with a Lubavitch Chassid fiance. What am I to do, writes the conservative rabbi to another important Jewish newspaper. What's the other side of Chabad? This is the rabbinic agitation, but from the lay point of view, what is their position on Chabad? We'll call it the not yet fully churched Jewish community. They are not full allegiance to conservative, reform, or Orthodox. How do they feel about the emergence of Chabad in Jewish communities? They're either not nearly as ferocious. They probably range from ambivalent to quite stoked about it. Look at source 2. Again, this represents just a few of many examples. I can give you a full source sheet of all these sources. This is from a Jew in Cincinnati complaining that the year before he was down on his luck, not at all a well-heeled member of the Cincinnati Jewish establishment, and he can't afford, Rachmana Litzlan, to pay for entry into a non-Orthodox synagogue or temple for the high holidays. And he would like to inform the public. Well, 2 years ago, in the second paragraph in Source 2, I found myself in the same situation. For what it's worth, let me share this solution with your readers. The answer to my dilemma came in the form of Chabad House. They were warm, welcoming, and most of all, understanding of the financial situation. Their philosophy was very simple. A Jew should not have to pay to pray. Their doors are always open for every Jew, and so are their minds. There's a tension, therefore, or there are two ships proverbially sailing past one another in the night. You have the rabbinic establishment who are on guard. Chabad, very successful. They're successful on the campus. If they're successful on campus, well, those Jews on campus eventually become lay leaders 10 years later. Some of them wealthy and willing to support Chabad establishments. Whether, on the other hand, you have the rabbis who are not at all interested in teaming with Chabad and feel very much like their turf has been encroached upon. So, to suggest that the agitation, the angst, the rabbinic angst about menorahs is predicated solely on the very judicial, political, and ideological church and state divider is, I think, to be naive. There is a swelling of agitation, but nevertheless, church and state was one of the ikare amuna, if you will, of the Jewish experience in America. So let's look at source 3. What did the Orthodox feel? Walter Wurzberger, who is a very important Jewish intellectual, professor of Jewish philosophy at Yeshiva University, editor of the RCA Journal Tradition, former president of the Rabbinical Council of America, former president of the Synagogue Council of America, a trans-denominational umbrella group, defunct ever since 1994. What does he write about it? And look in the bolded section in source 3. I would prefer a total separation of church and state. Frank, when he was interviewed about menorahs, I don't think it's in the cards, especially now, lest you think I made it up, especially now after the Reagan landslide. It's Mondale, not Carter. The president is obviously going to appoint very conservative justices to the Supreme Court. Not just the justices in plural, he's right. Four total Supreme Court justices, which transforms the judicial landscape of the United States. Ad hayom hazeh, really. Liberalism is prescribed in America today. And in my opinion, this conservative bent is going to be very much accentuated in such a situation. I think it is better to have the Jewish community as viable as possible. So what does Rabbi Wurzburger think? Who represents much of the Orthodox opinion at this time. What does he feel about Chabad menorahs?
It sounds like he would ideally want separation of church and state. He would like Judaism acknowledged as an equal religion, so he must have liked to hear Judeo-Christian tradition. But he's not really taking a position on the menorah, but it would sound like... we're equal if we put it in, or he's just being a pragmatist.
So pragmatically, I think that's exactly the right word, it's rather unwise to go about a rather unilateral position that you will see in a moment that conservative and reform are undertaking. Ideally, he would like the separation of church and state upheld, but in the Reagan 80s, that was simply not in the cards. More on the conservative position. We're going to skip around in this source sheet. Page 6. David Gordas, the son of a very important conservative leader, Robert Gordas, he himself a very important conservative leader. I want to acknowledge, with thanks, your invitation. This is a letter to, of all people, Mayor Koch, a Jew. In 1985, I want to acknowledge with thanks your invitation to attend the Hanukkah candle lighting ceremony in the City Council chambers on Monday, December 9th. While I appreciate your consideration in inviting me, I would not feel comfortable in attending in view of the American Jewish Committee's policy, which I heartily support, opposing religious ceremonies under governmental auspices and on government property. So here's a very important conservative leader offering his suggestion. Let's look at another conservative position, if I can find it.
That was not.
What, excuse me?
That was not.
It was Chabad sponsored at the time. This particular position, I will tell you, because I myself, you look in AJ Congress papers, I-77, I've been through these papers. This was very much under the Chabad auspices. I think what you're referring to is earlier, Rabbi Riskin had championed, and so it's not just a Chabad point of view, both Rabbi Riskin, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, Rabbi Avi Weiss later, in the late 80s, in solidarity with Soviet Jewry, a little different, offered these giant menorah ceremonies. This one was...
This is
sponsored by Chabad. We'll talk about it afterward, but this was absolutely sponsored by Chabad. I have the documents to prove it. There should be another one. Ah, yes. Page 7. Myron Fenster, who's on the right wing of the conservative movement. He's actually a graduate of Yeshiva College and is my predecessor's professor. He was actually an editor of the Yeshiva College Commentator, of all things, back in the 40s, I believe. Dear Phil, referring to an important Jewish communal leader at the time, go to off the record. I advised him, this is the third paragraph, referring to another authority, I advised him not to go over and light that menorah that night. In addition, I explained to him that the Lubavitcher in Manhattan and Ed Koch have complicated the issue. So this is very much tied to what we were suggesting. Even more, by making it a mitzvah to light the public menorah. That's the conservative position very much. The reform position is actually far more militant. From 1984 to 1986, the Committee on Cults and Proselytization considered issuing resolutions at the Central Conference of American Rabbis, the major rabbinical organization of the Reform movement, against Chabad, but instead decided, I think quite wisely, to table the discussion. That didn't stop the leader, the executive director of the Reform movement, Rabbi Joseph Glazer, from writing a letter to none other than the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I'm on page 5. This is a letter that, again, found in the same archival folders. Greetings and blessings. This is from the hand of the Lubavitch Rebbe to, you could look at it, is he acting Lakula or Lachumra? A joke, I guess, I'm borrowing from Rabbi Sobolovsky. The Lubavitch Rebbe is offering Rabbi Glazer a doctorate, calling him Dr. Glazer. So you can say that he's awarding him an honorary doctorate, or is he removing his rabbinic title? You can decide this one. Greeting and blessings. This is to confirm receipt of your letter of May 31st, and you can see, actually, that it's not dated, but one can imagine that he's responding rather late. The Lubavitch Rebbe was probably, I think, one of the busiest people in the United States. So yes, you could. It does indicate. Thank you. But I'm interested in the second paragraph. Had I received your letter years ago, this is in the mid-80s, when this practice started, I would have had a more difficult task of defending it. We know from other records that Glazer had defended church and state and asked the Lubavitch Rebbe to kindly, or not so kindly, cease and desist. And Lubavitch Rebbe admits that you're right, that I might have had a problem defending it if you wrote to me years ago, for the simple reason that that the expected positive results were then a matter of conjecture. But now, after the practice and results have been observed for a number of years, my task is an easy one, since the general acclaim and beneficial results have far exceeded our expectations. The fact is that countless Jews in all parts of the country have been impressed and inspired by the spirit of Hanukkah, which has been brought to them, to many, for the first time. Indeed, the eternal and always timely message of Hanukkah, the victory of the outnumbered forces of light over the overwhelming forces of darkness that attempted to make Jews forget God's Torah and mitzvot, struck the responsive chord in the hearts of many Jews and strengthened their sense of identity with the Maccabees of all ages. Interesting. So what's the Lubavitch Rebbe suggesting?
He's only defending it on the basis of his results. Nothing to do
necessarily. Are those worthy? Is it a non sequitur? Is that a worthy response?
No. But it's nothing to do with whether he supports the principle of separation of church and state, on its merits.
Okay. But what is the Chabad position on the Menorahs? What is the Chabad? We've discussed so far the opposition. The opposition is quite simple. I read to you the Establishment Clause, separation of church and state. What's the Chabad position on it?
The other part of the clause, that Congress will not establish religion nor prevent free exercise thereof. So they're going with the free exercise clause.
In other words, in America, we're not just protected from ourselves of display, whoever we are. America doesn't protect one another from others' religions. But it's, in a sense, what many historians of American religion call a marketplace of American religion. I can peddle my wares, and you can peddle yours. And that's the beauty of America. We have the right to ignite the spirit of all Jews with the flame of Hanukkah. Is that a non sequitur? Is that a worthy justification of the tradition of the Chabad menorah? No right answer. And what exactly is a menorah? What exactly is a menorah in the religious sphere? What's the analog? What is the analog? Well, there was a Supreme Court case, Lynch versus Donnelly in 1984, which took up some of this issue. Is that there's a spectrum of religious objects, but then there are objects which aren't religious at all. In the Christian world, in the Christian world, Donnelly versus Lynch proved actually quite the extreme. Not just is a Christmas tree, which is for holiday spirit, a minhag ba'alma, if you will, but not only that, but what is absolutely a religious object that we don't see anymore? A creche. For the uninitiated, what's a creche? It's a nativity scene. It is the birth of their Lord and Savior. Correct? And actually, in 1984, the Supreme Court ruled that, in fact, this wasn't a demonstration of a religious scene. Hard to make that case, as we'll find out, that was rescinded. That the Immaculate, well, this wasn't the Immaculate Conception, this was the end result of the conception, that in fact, this was mutter by a majority of the Supreme Court in 1984. They do, but in specific spaces. So it was limited, and we'll get to that Supreme Court case. Thank you very much. First, a little more on where exactly Orthodox fit in. Let's look at it for a moment. Page 8. In St. Louis, in a letter, a memorandum from a very important Jerome Shaines, if we look, the JCRC strategy is clearly born, I'm in the third paragraph, born fruit in its second year, but there is by no means unanimous feeling within the Jewish community, again referring to our menorah case, or among the rabbis that the public display of the menorah is inappropriate. To some degree, the menorah at the county government center is a symbol of the divisions in the St. Louis community between the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox. And it's true. The Orthodox Union, the Rabbinical Council of America, to my knowledge, never resolved to oppose the menorah whatsoever. Rabbi Wurzburger, whom we read, offered a rather ambivalent position, saying ideologically I would be opposed, but pragmatically, let's just try to inspire some Jews come December time. Just to be clear, if we go back to, again, apologize for skipping back and forth, but let's go to page 2. Noach Deer, source 6 on page 2. Noach Deer, what I believe now is a New York State federal judge, at the time was a councilman, writes about the opposition. He's an Orthodox fellow, very prominent Orthodox leader in New York until this day, writes as follows in an editorial responding to Chabad menorahs, referring to the reform opposition to menorahs. They will be judged, I'm in the first bolded section, by a higher authority, by some criticism in his order. So God, they will be judged by God, but nevertheless, writes Mr. Deer, now Judge Deer, this is something that I will still comment on given my position. The next bolded section, their constitutional theories and efforts over the years have crippled the financial situation of Jewish education, the essence of Jewish survival. And now they seek to undermine the symbol of Jewish survival. They're using their constitutional, I don't know what you would call this tree, to stop the Chabad menorahs, writes one Orthodox leader, and we won't have it, we are in solidarity, he writes with Chabad. However, look in the next page, page 3 in source 7, you have an article in the Jewish press. As a firm Jew, writes Mr. Baruch Cohn, as a firm Jew, I appreciate an occasional Jewish reminder when I walk down our predominantly Christian bedecked streets. I also appreciate the importance of a separation of church and state in creating a tranquil community environment that we all enjoy. I was disturbed to learn that Chabad equates menorahs to Goyisha Christmas trees. Which is, if there was ever an appropriate time to use the word Goyisha in print, I guess that's the time. Which is a non-religious symbol. We'll try to understand exactly what that means. Associated with the non-religious observance of a de facto American national holiday. Chabad analogized an unlit menorah, even had a reform rabbi testify to a Christmas tree minus a nativity scene below it. So what's he talking about? 1987. And I'll give you the affidavits. Let's turn to page 6. It's always good in my business to be friends with archivists. They will scan anything for you. And this one comes from Rodev Shalom, a very fine Reform temple in Pittsburgh with a very, very kind archival staff, actually. You know that it's a very interesting synagogue. They have a paid full-time archivist. Mark's statement. Page 6.
No.
Page 9. Excuse me, I have it backward. Thank you. Page 9. The rabbi of Rodev Shalom, Rabbi Mark Stateman, testifies in this affidavit the following. He is the associate rabbi of Rodev Shalom congregation, located on 5th and Morwood Avenues in the city of Pittsburgh. And he testifies to particular points in a very pithy argument. Number 4, the Chanukah menorah is a symbol of the religious holiday of Chanukah. This is the Reform rabbi. Is that true? I would think so. Judaism considers the lighting of the Chanukah menorah to be a religious act. Seems to be right. Seems to be agreeable. 6, the Chanukah menorah is viewed by most people as the sole tangible symbol of the holiday of Chanukah. Okay. Bakas, but no. Bakas not was, no?
Dreidel.
Dreidel. Okay, not the sole, but perhaps he would have said the most prominent symbol. Okay.
Most also a symbol of Judaism in ancient archaeology.
Could be, yeah. Certainly a Zionist symbol to this day. 7, most people, including many Jews, would regard a Chanukah menorah as a religious symbol, and indeed, it is generally regarded as a religious symbol. Interesting. No?
Well, it's a religious symbol.
It's not a religious symbol.
It's a holiday symbol.
It's a holiday symbol.
It's a religious symbol.
Okay. You are in very fine company with the Chabad rabbi of Pittsburgh. Turn the page. Page 10. Rabbi Yisrael Rosenfeld offers the following. He is very fine, Talmud Chacham. He gives you some of his bona fides, where he was ordained. He has published many responsa, Shusayel, Shaz, and Juvas. I'm not aware of them, but there's no reason to disagree, to doubt him. Look at the next page, so the right half of the page, under the heading, Lack of Religious Significance of Public Menorah Displays. Number 3. This is very important because this emerges as a Supreme Court decision of the County of Allegheny versus the American Civil Liberties Union. It finally decided in 1989. It is incorrect, as alleged by plaintiffs, meaning Rabbi Stateman, to constitute the menorah as a purely religious symbol. It is incorrect, as alleged by the plaintiffs, to conclude that the menorah simply has no secular use or significance. Further, it is incorrect, as alleged by the plaintiffs, to construe the menorah as a purely sectarian object. Based upon my knowledge and understanding of Jewish law, I conclude that these claims of plaintiffs are not true. 4, I am familiar with the laws and procedures for lighting Chanukah menorahs. All the laws and procedures in Jewish law regarding the Chanukah menorah pertain solely to the individual's own Chanukah lighting done in the privacy of his or her own home. Okay, that makes sense. Number 5, Jewish law prescribes no requirement, commandment, rites, or ritual pertaining to lighting the Chanukah menorah in a public place. Also true. It's a minhag. Minhag to light in the shul. It's according to Shulchan Aruch, but nevertheless, it's not a din derabbanan. It is not considered sinful or improper or a ritual omission to fail to light a Chanukah menorah in a public place. The only requirement of Jewish law pertaining to the lighting of the Chanukah menorah deal with lightings in the home. Okay. The following example makes this clear. And he proceeds. They're at loggerheads. It's very interesting that, in fact, who's taking the machmir position of Chanukah?
The Reform
rabbi. And who's taking a much more nuanced, but nevertheless lenient position? He's nuanced in the sense that there are many different conceptualizations of the placement and lighting of Chanukah menorahs. Is the Chabad rabbi. And so, in 1989, well, even before I explain this, let's understand the demographics and the sociology of American religion at the time. This is, I promised last time you would flip through the sources, the back page. This is unbelievable.
Can I just ask one question?
Yes.
What defines a religious symbol?
That is still taken up by the Supreme Court. And these are very important data points.
For us, what is the definition of a religious symbol?
for us, for Jews, for Orthodox Jews, for...
Even for all Jews, what is considered a religious symbol?
I think there is a variance of opinion. I think there is. I think...
Different levels, whether you're referring to Tashmishe Kedusha...
Right. So I.
Menorah is none of those.
Right. So in Bikvei Hatzon, I think it's Simon Dalid. Rabbi Herschel Schachter has a good article about this, about the Shmishei Kedusha and what exactly the different levels are, for a different talk, and maybe the Yaakov will bring Rabbi Schachter to give such a talk. I will certainly be present. it's an interesting question, one that needs to be negotiated. Is a talus bag Kedusha? Is it the same level as its tefillin? That's part of this dilemma. Does it retain its kedusha? Does a lulav after Sukkot? These are all actually not too complicated questions, but I don't want to broach the topic because it will open up, it'll move us far afield for a moment. But I want to share with you a sociological study, the Williamsburg Charter Survey of Religion and Public Life in 1988, a few months before the decision in Pittsburgh. Fabulous data. The question, table 31, it's response to the statement, it's okay, interesting jargon, for a city government to put up candles on government property for a Jewish religious celebration. But it says candles, it means Chanukah, it means menorahs, right? Skip down to the most telling statistic, the last two. Those who agree, priests, 89%. 8 disagree, and 3% don't know. Rabbis. 16% agree. If you look, just look at that agreement column, and you see the overwhelming majority of Americans who are satisfied with the Chabad menorah enterprise, except for rabbis. Rabbis, 16% versus 81% disagree, and 3% haven't yet decided. In the end, the Supreme Court ruled twice. There were actually two rulings. That, in fact, the analog to the menorah was the Christmas tree. It wasn't a full-fledged religious object. That's why we'll see probably quite soon that there will be large menorahs and public ceremonies. They ruled in such a way. And then the Pittsburgh City Hall and the ACLU said, okay, you rule that way. It doesn't mean we have to allow it. And then there was an injunction, a second Supreme Court ruling saying, yes, you do need to allow it. That wasn't at all clear. I lied. I want you to flip through your pamphlet one more time to page 3. It still remained an issue. And it takes me back to Chicago, of all places, a year after the Supreme Court issued its decision. Chabad attempted to light a menorah at O'Hare International Airport. And at first, the judge ruled that he would not permit it. Issues of whether that is a public space or not, and the degree to the public access to the space, still feeling very much beholden to the decision of the Allegheny case, which was decided 4 months before this. The Chabad lawyer complained, what the city of Chicago is saying is that we will celebrate Christmas as a secular holiday, but we will maintain the fight in court for the right to refuse to celebrate the holiday of another people. The Chabad lawyer argued that the Supreme Court and the Illinois Court was permitting this to be Protestant America, and how dare they? Well, the judge responded after several appeals, same judge, John Coffey, Source 9, if there were constitutional rights to put up structures on public property, our traditional public forums, such as our public, it should be parks, not arcs, would be cluttered with all manner of structures. Be no end. Everybody would be. There's a famous episode of Seinfeld called Festivus. So they'd be holding up Festivus poles. Public parks are certainly quintessential public forums where free speech is protected, but the Constitution neither provides nor has it ever been construed to mandate that any person or group be allowed to erect structures at will. In the end, I will tell you that a few years later, the decision was reversed. What's more important, whether or not Chabad is right or wrong to take a side on the issue, and that's not really what, as this room, I've deputized all of you as historians looking and analyzing primary sources. It's not an issue about whether they're right or wrong. The question, I want to return to my first step, which is the question of American exceptionalism. If one takes the side that, yes, the Jewish experience in the United States has been, sine qua non, the greatest in Jewish history, then what is the cause of it? Is it the Establishment Clause that allows or prohibits, I should say, depending on how you look at it, prohibits religious infiltration in the American cultural experience or legislative political experience to the point that in 2000, if some people in Florida had voted in a different direction or if had known how to tab the buttons a little bit differently, there might have been an Orthodox Jewish vice president of the United States. That didn't happen, but nevertheless, former Senator Lieberman wasn't just any senator. He was a leading official in the Senate. He wasn't just one of 100. He was only in America. Could that be? People point to Don Isaac Abravanel as a great political figure. Trust me, as a historian, Joe Lieberman had much more power politically, not religiously, not halachically, than the Abravanel in 1492. On one hand, there is that American exceptionalism. There is the notion that the Bill of Rights, that the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment protects us, that this is not a Christian country, it's not a Jewish country. It is a secular country which therefore empowers us because we can't do so publicly. The privatization of religion, the fact that we are allowed to do however we want to do and perform however we want to perform in our own places of worship, in our own homes, empowers we Jews to live differently, more exceptionally than ever before. But in the second half of the 20th century, well, that was a cardinal plank of Jewish experience, Chabad expressed another leitmotif, another notion of American exceptionalism, which is what? Before I state my opinion. If we look at this, what is the Chabad argument? What is the Lubavitcher Rebbe suggesting? What is the fact that they went to Supreme Court and won the day in 1989. What does that suggest? It's quite unbelievable.
We've made it. We're equal. We don't have to keep a low profile. We can compete in the marketplace with everybody else. We have a right to assert our constitutional, what we feel are our constitutional rights, and go use the court system. We don't have to, it's not going to be a shanda. We don't have to worry about a pogrom.
And I'll say there are two ideas that I want to tease out from that argument. From one, don't be ashamed. Light the menorahs. Don't worry about the ACLU. Don't worry about the comparisons to a creche, to a Christmas tree. Be a Jew and be happy about it. But then there's that other idea which you express in the latter half of the response, which is not only is there a freedom of expression, but the utilization of government systems to not just invite Mayor Koch, a Jew, no less, but also to take up the issue in Supreme Court, to use the American system as the finest marker of American democracy, of world democracy, to justify your point, not to do it in the private sector, but to help legislate and lobby. And that use of American exceptionalism, to take the culture of freedom and religious marketplace from the private sector, which Jews had done for many times, for centuries in the United States, but to move it to the public sphere. And Chabad, it's not the only instance that Chabad has used the Supreme Court, but to use legislative and governmental mechanisms to take on their rights as American citizens is just as much a right in this golden Medina than anybody else's view. And in their view, the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe was correct. America nisht underish. America is no different than ever before. We will use our mechanisms. We will work hard, both in the private sector and then, I don't know if he could imagine it, but in the public sphere as well, because that is the dual legacy of not just the Constitution, but the First Amendment. Both forces were interpreting America quite differently, but within the parameters of what indeed makes America nish underish, America not so different than ever before. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Aleph, and everyone should have a great day. Thank you for coming.